If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
And then the two desks side by side, which I think this image, more than anything, encapsulates the nature of their monarchy.
That was Professor Jane Ridley speaking from Victoria and Albert's private apartments at Osborne.
Other than London and East Anglia, these are experiences which most of the population would have experienced during the Civil War.
And that was Michael Constantine, manager of the National Civil War Centre, discussing the impact of this conflict. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo and Zinio. Look out for us in your app store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Welcome to our first podcast of June 2015. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. The palatial family home of Osborne on the Isle of Wight was one of Victoria and Albert's favourite retreats and was frequently used by the royal family when they wished to escape from the public eye. For the latest of our History Explorer pieces in the magazine, we sent our features editor, Charlotte Hodgman, to visit Osborne in the company of historian Professor Jane Ridley. Here's how they got on.
So we come to Osborne to talk about the Victoria and Albert and Victoria's reign and the couple themselves. Going back to the beginning, when did Victoria and Albert actually meet?
Well, Victoria and Albert met, they were first cousins.
Yeah.
And they met briefly when I think they were about 16. Mm-hmm. But that was not a significant encounter. The really important meeting was when Albert first appeared at Windsor in 1839.
Yeah.
And that was sort of, an immediate From Victoria's point of view, she saw Albert arriving from his journey covered in mud, and the crossing had been late and he'd lost his luggage. And she was at the head of the stairs, and she saw this sort of beautiful man at the bottom of the stairs, and she fell from that moment. She was completely besotted by him.
And then how long was it until that she got married? Because she proposed to him, didn't she? She had to...
Yes, indeed. The interesting statistic is how long it was before they actually got... She proposed to him. I mean, it was a matter of, I think, 5 days.
Oh, really?
Really quick.
Yeah.
She knew immediately. And she also, it's interesting, she didn't feel she had to tell anybody or consult anybody. She did actually tell Lord Melbourne, who's the Prime Minister, but also her great friend and confidant. Mm. But she didn't ask her mother, and she, she summoned Albert to her sitting room and sat him down on the sofa and asked him if he would marry her.
Could he have said no? Would it have been... could he have refused her?
I don't think... he could have delayed, I guess.
Yeah.
But I think the whole point was that Albert's sort of upbringing and education since he was a teenager had really, or even before, almost since he was born, his grandmother, they shared the same grandmother, and it had been her plan right from the beginning, the old lady in Coburg, that these two first cousins should marry. And certainly since Albert was a teenager, he'd been schooled and been to various... universities in Europe, all of which was designed to educate him in statecraft. And so this was his vocation.
So it wasn't a surprise for anybody then that they did actually end up marrying?
Well, I don't think it was a surprise within the immediate family.
No.
And particularly it wasn't a surprise to their uncle Leopold, King of the Belgians, who was also masterminding this operation. But to the British people, perhaps it was a bit of a surprise.
Well, I mean, were there any other sort of contenders or people on the horizon that she could have married?
Well, she could have married one of her cousins from Hanover, again a cousin. But there were no real contenders, and she could have married also actually a Prince of Orange. But there were no real sort of contenders for her hand. But I mean, remember, she is still very young, 19 or 20. She's been saying for quite a bit that she doesn't want to get married yet, that this would dilute her power. Even after she's married, she has doubts about whether she's sufficiently unselfish to get married. And I think there's, in Britain, there's quite a lot of criticism of the idea that, she's marrying yet another German beggar, as they were called, a German prince with no money, who's come to Britain in order to seek his fortune.
So their backgrounds were quite different then, were they?
Well, I mean, yes and no. They are first cousins.
Yeah.
They share a lot of, Victoria's mother, Victoire, was the sister of Albert's father. So, and they were delivered by the same midwife. They've got the same grandmother. Okay. And they've got family in common. But, Victoria, suddenly, when she accedes to the throne, age 18, is one of... if not the most powerful woman in the world. Mm-hmm. Britain, at that time, is an enormously wealthy and important kingdom. Whereas Albert, I mean, if you go to Coburg today, I don't think it's probably much different in terms of size as it was then. It's a city, but it's the size of a place like Salisbury, that the lands that belonged to Albert's father were about the size of the Isle of Wight, where we are today. Very, really, I mean, he was very much a poor relation compared to Victoria. So there's a huge difference between their between their sort of wealth, status, and power. Albert is what was known as a Serene Highness, it sounds rather cool being a Serene Highness, but Serene Highness was the lowest rank of German royalty.
Okay.
And Victoria had to bump him up 2 promotions when he married her and make him a Royal Highness. Albert had very little money. In a sense, it's slightly like we read about Prince Philip when he married, he allegedly only had 1 smart suit. Albert is he's very well connected, but he is not from a wealthy background, and he's also from a very dysfunctional family.
And what do you think he expected for the marriage? Do you think he expected to be made king, or to be on an equal footing to Victoria?
I don't think he actually expected to be made. No, he never asked to be made king.
No.
But in fact, at the beginning, he wasn't even, his status was, he was just a German prince, and he was never given an English title. I mean, he was never given an English dukedom.
Yeah.
Became Prince Consort. So in terms of sort of protocol, he accepted that Victoria was the queen. But his ambitions were for real power. Mm-hmm. And what he wanted was basically to do the ruling, which he did.
He did do that. Is that because she was having children and was having to take a bit of a step back, or she was happy to let him?
Well, this is a really interesting aspect of their relationship. Mm. To what extent, Victoria encouraged it, to what extent she resented it. And I think there's a combination of both. I think the thing is that, on the one hand, she adores, admires, worships, and is besotted by Albert. Mm-hmm. And she certainly recognises him as her intellectual superior. He's much more highly educated. He's trained in ruling.
Yeah.
That's what he's come to England to do. She, by contrast, has, she has the education of a sort of aristocratic girl of that time, quite a good education by those standards. Yeah. But she doesn't know any of the sort of history and sort of politics that Albert knows about. So she recognises his superiority. But, on the other hand, she... the way she survived her difficult relationship with her mother and also becoming queen aged 18 is because she has this really strong sense of entitlement. She knows that she has this hereditary right. She is the queen.
Mm.
So there's a conflict between, she wants to share power with Albert, but she doesn't want to give it up. And what sort of solves that problem or conflict in the short term is that she becomes instantly pregnant and then has, I think, 7 of her 9 children within 10 years, which means that she's pregnant or
what's called... time.
Laying up, as it was called. You had to stay in bed for six weeks afterwards for most of the time, exactly. So she is, can't. Do the sort of hands-on power that, and so there is a transfer of power to Albert. And on the one hand, she's always saying she adores him and he's so good at it. But on the other hand, increasingly there is tension between them.
Yeah, I mean, was Albert quite happy to take on that role? Do you think?
Oh, Albert was more than happy to take on that role. Remember, this is a very male-dominated society, early 19th century society, and Albert sees him, Albert makes rather wry remarks about how he is not the master in his own house, and Victoria goes out of her way to increase Albert's status at court and to make sure that... that he is recognised as being a person of equal rank with her.
Mm.
Albert is still really determined to take over power, and he's got really strong ideas about how he wants to use that power.
Like what exactly?
Well, I mean, he talked about constitutional monarchy, mm-hmm. and that's what he said he wanted to do. And a lot of people have thought, therefore, that Albert basically bought into the British idea of constitutional monarchy. But when Albert used that term, he meant something rather different. He didn't mean a monarchy really limited and controlled by Parliament. He meant a king who acted as a sort of permanent president.
Okay.
So he wanted a strong executive, with him as a sort of almost unofficial member of the cabinet, him constantly in touch with ministers, him completely in control of the whole agenda of the cabinet. And ministers would be summoned and grilled. But the person who would be asking the questions would be Victoria, who was just mouthing what Albert had told her to say. So Albert is doing a massive amount of work behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And Victoria is the kind of front woman.
The puppet, really.
The puppet. Albert writes all the letters and Victoria copies them out laboriously.
Right.
Victoria is there at the interviews. Albert prompts her in German. They speak German when they're together. And then Victoria says what Albert has told her to say. And, when ministers came who understood German, they could see what was going on.
That's interesting. How was Albert accepted by, members of Parliament and, the ruler? How was he seen?
Well, his popularity varies hugely.
Mm.
He gets on very well with some ministers, prime ministers. He gets on terribly well with Peel. Mm. Peel is a great, very organised, efficient... rather bureaucratic type of politician, and that's just the kind of person who Albert sort of relates to. He liked Peel for being a moderniser and an organiser and an efficient, clear-thinking person. But the he quarrels badly with some, and he quarrels really badly with Lord Palmerston, and they clash, particularly over foreign policy, because Albert has his own ideas about what Britain's foreign policy should be, and he doesn't agree with Palmerston's idea of encouraging sort of... for instance, the 1848 revolutions, which affect adversely a lot of Albert's German cousins who have toppled off their thrones temporarily. Yeah. So they fight, and Albert tries to get rid of Palmerston, does actually succeed in removing Palmerston as Foreign Secretary at one point. But then Palmerston comes back and is Prime Minister. And Albert is not terribly popular with the British public. He's seen as far too interfering. He is described in radical newspapers as a, quote, German beggar, out to get as much as he can get, which is actually unfair. That was not true, in money terms. But he's always rather stiff and rather cold and rather, you know, he's not good at sort of doing one of the key royal functions, which is recognising people, making people feel that you care about them. You know, he wasn't good at recognising faces. He was good, really good at getting things done, but he wasn't terribly good at the touchy-feely side.
Was Victoria better at that? Because she always strikes me as being quite cold and aloof as well.
Well, she recognised people. She was very good at remembering who she'd met. And she could, if she wanted to turn the charm on, she certainly could. But she could equally turn it off.
And you mentioned that they had, you know, they started their family very, very quickly. What was their relationship with their children like? Was it similar to how they'd been brought up?
Well, I think this is one of the sort of problems. Albert has very strong ideas how the family ought to, the royal family ought to be brought up. And in fact, what he wants to do is to distance the Victoria and Albert dynasty, if you like, from what had gone before, Queen Victoria's wicked uncles, you know, the Prince Regent and all the sort of scandals of the Regency. And so he wants to project the idea of the monarchy as being a domestic monarchy and the idea of a family.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's one wonderful painting, which I hope we might look at in a minute, which is Winterhalter's The Royal Family in 1846, which is here, which shows Albert and Victoria sitting in court dress with their children frolicking around, which of course is not real. But this was the idea of the monarchy as kind of domestic and family and, if you like, bourgeois values.
Yeah.
So that was the idea. But the problem was that neither Albert nor Victoria had had conventional or happy childhoods. They couldn't really do childhood. Albert had been brought up, you know, his mother was banned from court, exiled by his father when Albert was only five. And she was sent away and divorced because she was accused of having an adulterous affair with a member of the court. And of course, you know, Albert's father was a famous libertine and was doing this the whole time. And so Albert was brought up in sort of seclusion with his elder brother Ernest, with a very good tutor, just the two little boys in a sort of Hansel and Gretel house in the woods called the Ravenheim in Coburg. And so that was a very dysfunctional family. And Albert's father was a really dreadful man. And then Victoria, you know, her father died when she was a few months old. And so she was brought up alone by her mother. And certainly in her teens, that relationship was really bad. And her mother sort of treated her really almost like a prisoner. She had to sleep in her mother's room. She wasn't allowed to go anywhere by herself, etc. So neither of them knew what normal family life was like. And yet suddenly here they are with nine children. And trying to sort of project this great image of being the perfect family, the example for everybody to follow. And of course, inside the palace, things are not always terribly harmonious. No. And they're terribly, I mean, Albert is in charge of the education. And he has a very difficult relationship with his eldest son, Bertie, Prince of Wales, who is expected to be this prodigy and isn't at all, but refuses to learn any of his lessons. Yeah. It's really difficult. And Victoria, equally, is a very controlling and domineering and seemingly unloving mother to her elder children.
Yeah.
So it's not easy. But, you know, I don't think it is easy, this, you know, this living, this very exposed, this public-private life, you know. Yeah. Lots of pressures.
And that sort of brings us to Osborne, really, doesn't it? Because, I mean, this was meant to be the family home, wasn't it? That they couldn't really get back on the mainland. When did they sort of first start thinking about this type of place? You know, they wanted to bring the children.
Oh, well, they come here when their family is still quite young, sort of 1846, 1847. And they buy this place. Yes, they want a place where they can, as you say, get away from always being looked at, as they're always looked at in London or in Windsor. They want a complete sort of a place that's private. I mean, it was paid for out of Victoria's money, and it wasn't paid for out of the civil list. It wasn't one of the sort of public houses of the sovereign. So this is an escape. They want somewhere which is incredibly secluded.
And Albert himself had quite a lot of say in its design. Is that right? He had quite a lot of ideas about what he wanted from the house.
Yes. The house is very much designed by Albert. I mean, it's Albert's ideas carried out by Thomas Cubitt. He didn't employ an architect. He employed Cubitt, who was the man who built Pimlico. And one of the criticisms that people used to make of this house is that it is a bit like a chunk of London, sort of planted down into and all these great big plate glass windows as well made it very cold. But Albert has the central pavilion is we'll see it in a minute, but it is a wonderful building in a way, I think, the way it's sort of top lit. And the way that it was designed for the sort of family to be, there was the parents and then the children upstairs, and they felt, I think, slightly the children, that they were always being sort of observed when they were here.
What is completely fascinating is Albert's bathroom,
which these private quarters are the most amazing set of rooms, because after Albert died in 1861, Queen Victoria kept everything as it was when they were together. And so all Albert's things are as they were when he died. And then after Victoria died in 1901, her son, Edward VII, decided that he would not keep on Osborne. He couldn't afford yet another royal house because he had Sandringham as well, obviously. And so Osborne was turned over to be a naval college. But these rooms were kept as, there's a sort of iron gate there. And that gate was locked so that the naval college or nobody could come in here. They were kind of sacred rooms. Mm-hmm. And they were sort of kept frozen, therefore, in time, completely preserved. And then when the present queen acceded in 1952, whenever it was, these rooms were opened up to the public. So that they were totally preserved in a way that is completely unique. And the access is extraordinary, too, the fact that we can see them today.
Yes,
and so what's interesting is that one thing is really interesting is the interest in new technology. These baths were Albert's bath here, and also there's a shower at the back. Was plumbed so that the water ran away, and this was obviously to us it's we take it for granted, but it was a total novelty. You know, usually people had hip baths brought up, great big tin baths which would be filled with hot water by a maid, but this was running water that would run out the bath. So that was amazing. And also, we'll be able to see they had what Victoria called conveniences. She was very keen on the convenience, the water closet, which again was a total novelty. And she had water closets or conveniences installed in all her palaces with wonderful sort of mahogany Victorian seats. Yeah. And we'll be able to see it when we go to her room. But I think what's rather wonderful here is this mural which Albert bought, which is by a German artist in about 1830. And it's a picture of Hercules, terribly strong and muscly and masterful, surrendering all his power to the Queen of Lydia on the left.
Yeah.
And it could be that Albert just bought this picture because he liked it, and certainly it's the style that he likes, German mural style that he liked. But, of course, also it's an allegory of their relationship. You know, he is Hercules surrendering his strength and his influence to this woman. Mm. And also the other thing about it is that, obviously, this is two nude figures. And one of the things that's interesting is that in the pictures that they gave each other and the sculpture that they gave each other was often of nudes and often almost faintly erotic. And of course, this the relationship, particularly on Victoria's part with Albert, was, she had a very strong physical passion for him.
It's one of my favourite rooms, I think this one is.
This is a lovely room.
Mm.
This is the room. What's it called, this room? The Queen's sitting room.
Mm.
And there were the lovely bay windows looking out, as you can see, over the Solent. Beautiful view. And they would stand here in the evenings listening to the nightingales, which they could hear from these windows. And then the two desks, side by side, which I think this image, more than anything, encapsulates the nature of their monarchy, the joint monarchy, Victoria and Albert. And notice that they're not quite identical, these desks. Albert's desk on the right has a slightly higher... the bottom of the desk is slightly higher. Victoria's is a bit lower because she was so small, so that she could actually reach the desk. but this is where they worked together, and this is where they did went through those red boxes that would come down from London on the train every day, which had to be gone through even when they were on holiday. And you can see Victoria's desk also cluttered, as was always the case with Victoria, with endless photographs and miniatures and of all her huge family, royal relations. When she was in a real temper, which she occasionally was, she would sweep all of the stuff onto the floor. Terrifying.
It's always tempting, isn't it? Oh, it's a lovely room.
But it's all very small and simple, isn't it? I mean, this is like a flat. You know, he has his two rooms. There's his sitting room in the middle. And then we'll see in a minute there's her bedroom.
Yeah.
And their joint bedroom.
It's all sort of quite self-contained up here, isn't it?
I think one could quite happily...
just live up here. Yes. Yeah. Because what you've been saying about Albert is kind of... I think quite a few historians think in the past have sort of... Well, from what I've read, have sort of described him as he was sort of. She tried to pacify him by giving him little bits to do, but that doesn't seem to be that actually the case, you know. That,
well, it starts by that. She pacifies him by letting him blot her letters.
Yeah.
At the beginning, and giving him little chores, but then but quite soon she allows him completely to take over. Yeah. He has a water closet. you can see how it can't lift it. It's nailed down. But anyway, it's rather sort of public place, isn't it? It's a passage.
Well, yeah. Yes, you'd hope that she had some sort of curtain.
And this is the Queen's bedroom. And of course, this is very interesting because this was the bed in the room in which Victoria died.
Oh, okay.
In 1901. Mm. This is where she came to die. She died in a very... she's a monarch through and through, Victoria. It's a bad idea if you're a monarch to have a long, prolonged period of dementia, because it creates constitutional issues.
Yes.
Who's going to do the reigning? Victoria gets ill and is dead within a few days after Christmas in January 1901. And she was at first in this rather splendid double bed.
Mm.
But when she becomes very ill, she's moved into a little bed in the middle of the room.
Okay.
And it was in that little bed that she had... The deathbed took place and, you know, all her family gathered around. And she was supported on one side by the person who the rest of the family really didn't want to come, but who insisted on coming, who was her nephew, Kaiser William II of Germany. And, you know, he holds up his grandmother. He's only got one arm that works, as a withered arm, but with his left arm, he holds her up.
Okay.
And then he never ceases to use that moment for publicity purposes later on, self-promotion purposes. but, of course, also the other thing about this bed is that this is where Victoria slept for 40 years after Albert died. And she, in her bed, she would have... Albert's dressing gown and various other bits of memorabilia to remind her of her beloved husband.
Where did Albert die? He didn't die here.
Albert died at Windsor.
Windsor.
No, but after Albert's death in December 1861, Victoria doesn't go to his funeral. I mean, it's true. It was, you know, not... Women didn't always go to funerals, often didn't go in the Victorian period, but she just couldn't bear... to, you know, the sort of emotion of it. And so she came here. She came to Osborne and she hid here for many months.
With her children? Or were her children around?
Yes. They were.
Yeah.
Except for Vicky, who was married. Her children were here with her.
That was Professor Jane Ridley and Charlotte Hodgman at Osborne. Jane is the author of a new biography of Queen Victoria that has just been published in the Penguin Monarch series. And as I mentioned earlier, you can read more from Charlotte and Jane in the June issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now. Also in the magazine, you'll find articles on Anne Boleyn, Waterloo, King John, and the Ardennes, among other things. You can get hold of our June issue now in all good newsagents and digitally.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/History Extra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/History Extra.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Now it's time for the latest history news with our website editor, Emma McFarnan.
The American government paid more than $20 million in Social Security benefits to more than 130 United States residents linked to Nazi atrocities over the course of more than a half century, it has been claimed. According to the New York Times, a federal investigation has revealed that more than three dozen former Nazis received a total of $5.7 million in Social Security benefits before they were ultimately deported. Another 95 suspected former Nazis, who received a total of $14.5 million in Social Security benefits, were never deported and continued receiving benefits. Some died before they could be deported, while others fled the country. According to the federal investigation, some of the payments were made as recently as this year. Investigators concluded that virtually all of the payments were proper under policies in place at the time, and that federal officials did not have the legal authority to prohibit benefits until a Nazi suspect was deported. In other news, the discovery of a headless human skeleton has prompted archaeologists working on the Crossrail project to consider whether headhunters might have stalked Roman Britain. The skeleton, which dates from the Roman period, was uncovered 20 feet beneath Liverpool Street in the heart of the City of London, as part of a £15 billion scheme to establish a 26-mile rail network across the capital. The skull had been placed between the victim's legs, the Telegraph reports. A team from the Museum of London Archaeology has also found several skulls in a neat row alongside a tree-lined Roman road. The theory, up until now, based on the discovery of other skulls in this quarter of the city, was that the heads had simply washed up here from an ancient cemetery. However, lead archaeologist Jay Carver said, "These discoveries can't all be explained by the natural environment. I think we're now looking at a mix of origins. Some of the skulls are likely to have arrived here through erosion by the river. but evidence is also mounting to support the theory that this part of London was an execution and display area. It is possible the skulls were collected by Roman or British headhunters who decapitated their enemies in battle and displayed the heads as trophies. Alternatively, they may simply have been set down on the ground, raising the possibility that the skulls were part of a ritual dedication. Meanwhile, underwater archaeologists believe they have made the first ever discovery of the wreck of a slave ship that went down with slaves aboard. Several artefacts have been found at the wreck of the São José Paquete de África, a Portuguese vessel that sank off the South African coast on its way to Brazil in 1794, the Daily Mail reports. The artefacts, which include shackles, a wooden pulley block, and an iron ballast that helped weigh down a ship carrying human cargo, are believed to be the first ever recorded from a slave ship wrecked while transporting enslaved people. The items will be loaned to the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. More than 200 of the 400 slaves on board drowned when the ship foundered on submerged rocks about 100 metres from the shore.
Thanks for that, Emma. Before our next interview, I'd like to remind you that tickets are now on sale for our two history weekends this autumn, with speakers including Michael Wood, Alison Weir, Susanna Lipscomb, and Lloyd Grossman, among others. The events are taking place at Malmesbury, Wiltshire, from the 15th to the 18th of October, and in York from the 25th to 27th of September. Full details and tickets are now available at historyweekend.com, and BBC History Magazine subscribers will get a discount on ticket prices. Now, early in May, the new £5.4 million National Civil War Centre opened in Newark, telling the story of the bloody conflict that engulfed the British Isles in the middle of the 17th century. Just before the centre opened, Charlotte Hodgman donned a hard hat and a high-vis jacket and went to find out more about the centre and the historical buildings that house it. Now, as work was still taking place during Charlotte's visit, I hope you won't mind that there's a small amount of background noise during this recording.
So, you want to start in the beginning?
Let's start at the beginning, yeah. So what are you doing here?
Well, welcome to the National Civil War Centre Newark Museum here in the centre of Newark. You can just see the magnificent church in the background. What we're doing is we're building the National Civil War Centre in a set of buildings called the Old Magnus Buildings, which date back to 1529. People have been saying, why are we building it here? What's the point of it? What are we doing here in Newark? And one of the things that Newark has been famous for is for its Civil War earthworks and its Civil War history. But about 10 years ago, the Museum Service had a long, hard look at it. They looked at it and went, we're not telling this story. Economically, it was cheaper to pay a member of staff to stand at the door and pay everybody 20 quid not to go in. It didn't have, we also had this set of historic buildings that, in 2006, this set of buildings was entirely unoccupied. It had no beneficial use, and its use was up for review. So they looked at the two challenges and thought, right, what are we going to do with them? We've got a set of buildings without a use, we've got a museum service that's cost a lot of money, and we've got this huge Civil War story which we're not telling. And from that grew a project to build the National Civil War Centre in the restored Old Magnus buildings. Yeah, went to the Heritage Lottery Fund after a few stages. We got £3.5 million grant from the Heritage Lottery Fund. Newark and Sherwood District Council is the local authority. They've put £2 million into the project, and the County Council have put another £500,000 into basically the augmented reality trail that takes you around the town. So about 3 years ago, that's when the project really crystallised, and we went out to tender for the major conservation works, which you can hear. Yes. Still happening at the moment, yeah. Just finishing off.
Well, about a week away are we now from?
We're about 8 days approximately from opening, minus 2 hours.
And how's it gone? I mean, has it been a sort of smooth running from the project? Have you hit any sort of problems along the way?
The people did mock Donald Rumsfeld for saying that you don't know what you don't know. And on this project, we have been with him behind those words every step of the way. It's the kind of thing of, as Simon, who's the major conservation guru, will outline when we get into the Tudor building, you know, you've got a building that's thick end of 500 years old.
Yeah.
Bits of it were rebuilt in the early 20th century, but the bits that we needed to rebuild weren't. And it's only when you remove tens of tons of lime ash concrete out of a building and find out what's underneath it that you find some interesting conservation challenges.
Yeah, I mean, the building overall is one that's developed over time, although it dates back to 1529. There was a building stock on the front of it in the early Georgian period. You've also got a Victorian extension, then an Edwardian extension, then two further Edwardian extensions. Right. So it's a real mishmash of buildings, a real mishmash of level, a real kind of mishmash of buildings tied together as well. And actually unpicking some of that proved to be pretty problematic. We also uncovered a fair amount of evidence where, that points to, let's say that cowboy building isn't necessarily a modern invention.
Oh, really?
Certainly, the Georgian building was
cobbled together a bit. It was
all secondhand materials.
Yeah,
and so it's that kind of classic thing of, you know, people say, "Oh, Victorians and Georgians built magnificent buildings," and yes, they did, and they also built some buildings that were built definitely to a budget. And the budget wasn't enough to build the building in the first place.
And this is probably one of them.
Bits of it were. I mean, we were really worried with the extensions on this bit. Because what they were looking at, we were thinking, you know, we know that that's a main building, it's had a ground floor extension, then they put a first floor on top of it. So we were really worried about this.
Yeah.
However, the main building had no foundations in. It was like three layers of bricks with no cement.
Wow.
The extension has got brick foundations that go down 12 feet. Yeah. So the bit that we were worried about actually didn't need any underpinning, and the rest of it just needed completely, you know, needed foundation for the first time.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, our building inspectors were saying, you know, lots of these buildings are held together by no more than habit because they were lashed up, and trying to make them fit together in a modern, safe and cohesive way has been a major challenge.
It certainly has.
So what can people expect when you finally open the doors?
Well, as we'll be able to show you, they'll get the full spectrum heritage museum experience. You know, real things in glass boxes with labels, digital interactives could surf you around those objects, especially commissioned films so you can see how muskets work and how they're fired, replica arms and armour and civilian clothes so you can try them all on and get that feel of being able to touch history. You know, cinema, which has got, you know, what we've got, 6 5-minute you know, cinema films in it. These are kind of full cinema quality films. It's not the usual thing you get.
No Brilliant.
Do you want to go look at stuff?
That sounds good.
So we're now stood in what we call the Tudor Hall, which is the heart of the original kind of Tudor structure.
Wow, what an amazing room.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it?
Yeah.
One of the kind of interesting things about the project, and the bit that perhaps people often overlook, is that this project has already had a fairly major refurbishment. And this room and this part of the building was very heavily renovated in 1914, and there's still kind of evidence of blacks are there.
Yeah.
You know, that moment of the kind of centenary of the First World War is actually kind of the same as what we're doing now. A lot of the timber work here is the result of contemporary to the construction of the building. There are two big mezzanine sort of floors here. If you look up as well, you kind of start to get the first indication of some of the kind of work that we've done in here. If you see that those are these big beams that run across the centre there, those are, I think, 13 metre lengths of seasoned oak, and we've had to manhandle and winch all of those in because they're actually the foundation, as well as being part of the roof in here, they're also an integral part of the roof structure. So that was quite a challenge.
Right, so we're even higher now.
That's it, yeah. Nearly at the highest level. The highest level is up there, which is the second floor Georgian. We're at the top level of the Tudor building at this level, so we'll take you through into the Tudor dormitory, which is where all the fun and games happen.
This is where the kids that were involved in the school would have slept, and is probably one of the earliest surviving medieval roofs within the town, I would say.
Lovely.
The Tudor building, when it was built, 1529, we think was probably the third best building, the high status building in Newark, which, bearing in mind you've got Newark Castle and the magnificent Mary Magdalene Church, is, you know, it was an incredibly high status building when it was built.
It's massive stone walls, great big sucking wooden roof on top of it. Yeah, fantastic building. Also remember that when this building was built, building materials are really expensive and they're difficult to produce. We've looked at some of the bigger beams that we've had to put in here. Now, if you think to make one of those beams, you have to fell a tree, you have to drag the tree from where it was, wherever it was felled. You then have to saw it, which is two guys, one down a big hole, one at the top of the hill with a really big saw, just going like backwards and forwards. And, you know, and that's to make one of those beams is you know, a week's work, basically. Yeah. So anything that they can reuse, any materials that they can take from a building that's currently been derelict, that's what they'll do. And certainly, although this roof dates from 1529, it's a very fair bet that a lot of the timbers in here actually date from a much earlier medieval building.
So that's when we came in here, and when we thank Donald Rumsfeld every day for his wise words of you don't know what you don't know. So on top of here, there was we knew from the measured survey there was about 150 mil, 6 inch gap of knowledge within this floor. So we knew what was underneath it, and we knew what was on top, we just didn't know what was in that sandwich.
No man's land.
Yes, until they took off, 2 inches of lime ash concrete? So there's, 10 plus 20 tons of lime ash concrete on top of this. To then expose these, or a lot of these boards, which were from the original Tudor building.
Yeah.
Take the boards up, and then it's only then you can see the beams that are underneath. It's when the structural engineer at the corner of, I think it was this post, kneels down and with his bare hand, with his gloved hand, is just literally getting handfuls of sawdust and just dust out of what should be a structural joint.
Oh God!
It was at that point we knew that this was going to get an interesting job.
Yeah, well, actually, on that particular job, the story then got much worse. But then what we discovered was that this huge timber that's supporting a good chunk of this really heavy roof is actually cut off. about a metre and a half from where it should base onto the wall plate. And then we discover there's a piece of steel running away from that going downstairs, and we follow the steel down, and then we discover that it's actually bearing off of one of the floor trusses for the roof below. And we often said that we would have loved to have been in the meeting where somebody thought that was a great idea.
Just cut that off. Yeah. And I'll see you Monday.
Yeah, go home. Yeah, go home early.
Get some stealing. He'll be right.
God.
Big deal before anybody notices. When you're doing any kind of project like this, there are some sort of fundamental principles that you need to apply to the work. The first thing you need to do is conserve as much of the historic fabric as possible. I mean, the easiest thing in the world would have been to take all of this roof away, chuck it in a skip, bring some steel in, rebuild the whole thing out of steel. We can cut the steel with timber so it looks like the original thing. But you know what? At that point, it ceases to be a historic building. What it then becomes is a replica of a historic building.
Yeah.
Any building like this is the sum of its parts. It's the sum of the historic elements that make the story of the building. And the more of that you take away, the less of the value of the historic building is left.
Well, yeah, you might as well have it anywhere, might
absolutely.
You, I suppose.
So we decided to take the much more kind of difficult course, which was to repair and conserve as much of it as possible. So every, if the end of a beam was gone, we'd cut the beam back to that point, rejoint it to that point, and leave as much of the original material in situ as possible.
Yeah.
There are some other principles in there as well. As much kind of as much repair work as we do has to be honest. In other words, you have to be able to see the joins. You have to be able to see what's new and what's old, which is something else that we've done. The other thing is it just has to be quality. It just has to be good. It's a historic building. It deserves our best efforts and our best intentions.
So here we are in the National Civil War Centre. Final finishing touches being put on some bits of it. Mm-hmm. Other bits of it, we've got the cases in. There's lots of historic objects going in. The interactives, the digital interactives are in. They've gone in this afternoon ready for testing. And what you can see is we're telling the story of the British Civil Wars, because they're not the English Civil Wars. The Civil Wars start in Scotland, finish in Ireland, arguably finish in the colonies over in Virginia, sometime after the wars and of the Three Kingdoms over here. But we take a very kind of, I wouldn't say simplistic, but we tell the story in a very easy way, because there's lots of different elements to it. And what we do is we tell them in a brief way for people in a leisure mindset, so that they can get into it. And then if they want further information, it's readily accessible from. So what we like to do in modern exhibitions is we layer the information. You've got the initial level, and then if you want to dig deeper into it, we've got either digital or physical ways you can do that, digging deeper text or the digital interactive, so we can do that. You can see, like, just over to our right, Bernie and Will there in some of the showcases for the Royal Armoury stuff. We've got several hundred items going in this gallery, and we've probably got about 10% of it in, so we've got quite a way to go. But Royal Armoury stuff arrives in on Monday for a two-day fit-out. So what we've got is enormous showcases. These showcases are about 3.5 metres tall. Two of them, one of them will be about cavalry, one of them will be about infantry, showing you the different arms and armour that they've got. You're able to, there's object labels in there so you can read about them. There's digital interactives in front of each one so you're able to have a look at them, but also use the video. We've had filming shot where you can see musket drill, you can see pike drill, so you can see how these weapons would have been used in anger. And that's a different way of people being able to understand what it is they're looking at.
Yeah. Just to get some of the artwork you've got as well around, sort of.
Yeah, what we've got is, it's kind of, doing my best to describe it, is instead of sticking words and pictures on the wall, we've made the walls be able to take the pictures. So with digital printing, you can print now onto the wall. So that we've made a false wall. So we're, on this side, because we're in the legacy section, you've got a picture of the Bosca below. You've got a kind of world turned upside down and the graphic of Charles I's execution. But they become part of the wall rather than being, this is an image which you look at. So that's the way we've chosen to do this. And we think it's the way of using modern technology, modern printing methods, to be able to tell a story far better than just sticking pictures and text on a wall. So there we go. So if we start off over here, we've got the start of the Civil Wars. Just behind here, we've got the riot in St. Giles' Cathedral, which is one of the precursors to the Bishops' Wars, which is Charles I and Archbishop Laud trying to impose their new Book of Common Prayer on the Scots. Scots don't take kindly to it. Riot in St. Giles' Cathedral, and then you get the First and Second Bishops' Wars. That's where Charles I goes up against the Scots. Even though the Scots are one of his kingdoms, he is king of the three kingdoms, he loses twice, and the Scots occupy the north of England and charge him the princely sum of £850 a day to occupy the north of England. He needs cash to be able to pay that. He summons Parliament back. Parliament say, you've only summoned us back for cash, because they're quite astute like that. And then they give him what's called the Grand Remonstrance. It's this whole list of things that he's done wrong and they'd like him to change. And things go downhill from there, really. So that leads us into the Kingdom of Unrest and the Civil Wars. Other than London and East Anglia, these are experiences which most of the population would have experienced during the Civil War. There were the thick end of 300 sieges. Now, manor houses through to towns and cities that would have felt some kind of siege. Newark had three sieges, but ours are particularly well recorded, so we're able to tell those civilian stories.
So what would it have been like to have been under siege then here?
When we say siege, most people have the idea of it, you know, it's like medieval siege of a castle with dead cows
and
being
permanent, you know, permanent.
Yeah, permanent stay. Now, Newark was under siege for three times. The final siege lasted 6 months. It's only in the last half of that 6 months where you get what you would recognise as a siege, where the town is completely cut off. Until then, you would be under siege, but it would be kind of a loose siege because they didn't have the men or the money to completely encircle towns, especially not largest towns. Because with the earthen defences and with cannons on top of it, the cannons have got a really good range. You're talking of a range, an effective range of 5 miles. You're talking muskets that can work good 50 to 100 yards. So if you imagine you could dig trenches all the way around that, a mile away, that takes a lot of men.
So it was
only until the final half of the final siege, where there's 16,000 men surrounding Newark, that they've got the men, the money and the material to dig lines all the way around, and trench lines and fortifications, and that's when Newark becomes cut off. So, I mean, Oxford was under siege, but the king slips away from Oxford in the night and comes and surrenders outside Newark to the Scots. So whilst Oxford was under siege, it wasn't besieged as Newark was with trenches all the way outside, because that takes an awful lot of men and money. So that's a different siege. Yeah. Second siege, the Newark was being bombarded, but people could still get in or out. Third siege, they could get in and out until the last half, and then it became
completely sealed off.
That was Charlotte Hodgman speaking to Michael Constantine, manager of the National Civil War Centre, and Simon Butler, conservation manager for Woodland Heritage. The National Civil War Centre is open now, and you can find out more details at nationalcivilwarcentre.com. And if you'd like to read more about the Civil War, then do check out our May edition, which is still available as a back issue, and features an article on the myths of the Civil War. Well, that's pretty much it for this week, but do join us next time when we'll be talking about King John as we approach the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.